and learning more about Unitarian Universalism and Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. New members, friends, and those thinking about joining the church are invited to join the UU orientation class. This will be next Sunday, November 17th, from noon to 2:30. And you can keep an eye on the newsletter and email for further information. And I take that back. That's next month, not next week.
Come into this place and bring the story of your life, tales of triumph and despair, tales of joy and tales of sadness. In this house, all stories are welcome. All tales can be told. Come, let us worship here together.
May the warmth and light of this chalice illuminate our stories and make our life glow.
Would you please stand in body or spirit and join in singing our opening hymn, number 1058, BR's Religion. We're going to do this two times through because it's one we're not quite as familiar with.
welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Church. We are a community of people who infuse the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Laura Levenhagen, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. We are a welcoming committee, congregation, and hope that all visitors, whoever you are, whatever you are, and wherever you are on life's journey, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service. And while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and everyone is invited to join in. Please take a moment now to silence all electronics that you may have with you today. And again, welcome to everyone here this morning. We are happy that you have chosen to celebrate and worship with us.
One of the ways that we care for the wider community here is by contributing to local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have brought anything to share, please bring them forward or ask a child to bring them forward for you. And I invite the children to stay up front for a story. About all of you, but everywhere I've ever gone, there's always somebody who wants to tell everybody how much better they do stuff. Have you guys met somebody that likes to tell everybody, "I am wonderful"? And they brag and brag. Yeah, they're not much fun, are they, though? Today's story is about a rooster named Ego. And this is written by Tumbletree. Once there was a little bitty farm somewhere near here. No one had ever heard of it. And it was a happy farm and a quiet farm until a little rooster named Ego got big enough to crow. At first, he crowed in the morning like roosters are supposed to. Can you guys crow? What's a rooster sound like?
You got it.
He crowed to let everybody know it was time to get up, just like he was supposed to. Well, one day, Ego noticed that every time he crowed, the sun came up. Ego thought, my crow makes the sun come up. Well, he was so excited, and he crowed at the top of his lungs. And he walked back and forth going, I'm the best. I'm the greatest. No one is better than me. And he liked crowing so much that he crowed all day long. He was still crowing when the sun went down. And he noticed. And he said to himself, look, my crow made the sun go down. Then he started to crow all night. And he crowed, no one is greater than me. No one ever has been, and no one ever will be. I bet you can guess what all the animals thought about him by the next morning. They were tired. They hadn't been able to sleep a wink because he crowed all night. And that was just one night. They were sure that he'd stop crowing all the time about how great he was, but he didn't. He continued to crow day and night. He just didn't even seem to need to sleep. He just needed to tell everybody how great he was So the animals got together, and guess what they decided? They decided it was time for him to go crow somewhere else. Ego was on top of the chicken coop crowing when the pig said to him, "That's a great crow you got there, Ego. It's a shame it's not going up higher." And he stopped for a minute and said, "Why should it be higher?" "Well," said the pig, "if you were higher, more people could hear that wonderful crow of yours." Ego realized he was right. If he crowed somewhere higher, more people could hear him. So he looked around the farm to see what the highest place was. The barn's roof was high, so he jumped in the air and started flapping his wings as hard as he could. Well, he barely made it to the top, because chickens are pretty lousy flyers. But he could see the whole farm from up there, and other farms too. And he crowed and crowed and crowed so that everybody could see how great he was. A couple of barn swallows flew over and landed next to him and said, "Wow, that's a great crow you got there. Too bad you're not over on the tree over on the next hill." So he stopped crowing and said, "Well, why would I want to be over there?" Well, said one swallow, thinking fast, "if you crowed from the top of that tree, the whole valley could hear you." Ego realized he was right. He flew to the top of the tree as fast as he could. After he caught his breath, he started crowing again. A few minutes later, an owl came out and said, "What are you doing?" "I'm crowing." "Well, why?" "So the whole valley can hear how great I am." The owl thought quickly and said, "It's a shame you're crowing here and not from town." "Why?" said Ego. "Well, they've got very tall buildings. If you crowed, then the whole county could hear you." Ego realized the owl was right, and without even saying thank you, he landed on the luggage rack of a car, headed for town. When he got there, he did what he'd always did. He flew as high as he could and got to the top of the tallest building and started to crow. He crowed and crowed and crowed and told everybody how great he was. And soon some pigeons landed and said, "Why are you crowing here?" "Well, I'm telling everyone how great I am." They rolled their eyes for a minute and said, "Too bad you're not crowing from that mountain way over there." "Well, why would I want to do that?" said Ego. "Well, that way the whole world could hear you," said the pigeon, smiling. So he flew off to the top of the mountain. He couldn't get all the way there by himself, because remember, chickens are lousy flyers. So he had to land on top of a train to carry him there. And every once in a while, the train would blow its horn. What's a train horn sound like? Anybody know? Yep. Well, he thought the train was trying to crow louder than him, so he'd crow right back. He thought his crow was better. He was almost crowed out by the time the train reached the mountain, and he flew off the train and climbed all the way to the top. And every morning he would crow to make the sun come up, and crow and crow and crow to the whole world about how great he was, and crow to make the sun go down. And some people say he's still on that mountain, and the other animals just smile, because it's quiet where they are. And the small farm that he once called home is happy again, and nobody misses his crowing all the time. Thank you very much for listening to my story. Would my lantern bearer please come up? And would you all help me to sing the children to their classrooms? sister was desperately in want of $1,000 to make ends meet at the church. And he wrote to a wealthy congregant as follows, "Dear friend, if you could see how I blush with shame for what I am writing, you would pity me. Do you know why? Because I have to ask you for a mere $1,000 and do not know how to express myself. No, it is impossible for me to tell you. I prefer to die. I send this by messenger, who will, of course, wait for an answer. Believe me, dearest friend, this wounds me to the heart. Signed, your most humble and obedient servant and minister. P.S. Overcome with shame for what I've written, I've been running after the messenger to take this letter from him, but I cannot catch him. Heaven grant that something may happen to him to stop him, and I beg that this letter may be lost." The congregant was naturally touched at the minister's inability to ask for money, but was equal to the emergency. He replied as follows, "My dear minister, console yourself and blush no more. Providence has heard your prayers. The messenger lost your letter, and we will say no more about it." "Because I have no skill at letter writing or catching messengers, the morning offering will now be given and received." Thanks for these gifts given and received for the life and work of this community. Our community and our church could not exist if it were not for the members who make up our congregation. Today we will be welcoming three new members who join us in beloved community. Would Megan and Zeke and Susan and Linda please come up and join me? Now, would you join me? Here in this church, human beings have gathered seeking a higher purpose and deeper life than we could find alone. We are grateful today for each one of you, that you have found your way here and that you have decided to make a commitment to this faith community. We hope that as a member of this church, you will allow yourselves to know and be known, to minister to and to be ministered unto, to love and be loved by this congregation. We never really know what combination of fate and friendship and good luck it is that brings people together in this world for any purpose. But we believe that membership in the church calls each of us here to celebrate the fate that has drawn us together, and to regard each one as a spiritual friend and potential teacher, even of occasional hard lessons. The relationships we form in our church are based on the needs of the soul, needs that render each of us vulnerable and therefore reliant on each other's grace and goodness and generosity of spirit. As members of this church, we pledge to be guardians of each other's spirits, to respect the ultimate privacy of each one's human struggle, and to believe in each one's inherent dignity.
Hi, I'm Al Haskell, and I'm here today apparently representing the Board of Trustees, Stewardship, and the Membership Committee. I want to personally welcome the four of you. I'm thrilled to have you after the service join the historic ledger, which dates back to 1997. First signatures. As we come together, we recognize that each member must make a contribution to our religious organization, supporting the life and work of this community financially and through gifts of time and talent. Together, we make this a vital and dynamic congregation, working for positive change in ourselves and the world.
A member of a Unitarian Universalist congregation makes a free choice to join their life with that of a religious community. If you, standing here with me now, are ready to affirm that choice, please repeat in unison the words on the sheet I've just handed you.
I am ready. I will do my part to maintain the ongoing life and work of this congregation. I pledge to build relationships of mutual trust and respect within the community and work towards congregational well-being and service in all that I do here. As a symbol of this promise, I will sign my name in the membership book.
It is the joy and duty of our congregation to welcome you into this community of faith. With the members of the congregation, please stand. Please read in unison the words of covenant and welcome included on the sheet in your order of service. We welcome you among us, and we invite you to join us in the life and work of this community. In the bonds of fellowship and love, we unite to cultivate reverence, to promote spiritual growth and ethical commitment, to minister to each other's needs and to those of humanity, to celebrate the sacred moments of life's passage, and to honor the holiness at the heart of the being.
So as symbols of welcome, we have a cherished autographed certificate. Let's see, that's Megan, Susan, and Linda. And then I also have a candle. See if you want to grab that. And so if you would, you can light your candle as a joining of the symbolism of Unitarian Universalists and our church.
time in our service where we share our joys and concerns, and we do this in two ways, by speaking them aloud and by lighting candles. Would anyone who has a joy or a concern to share, please raise your hand and the ushers will bring you a microphone.
I'm Christy, and we have a candle of joy for our daughter Carrie and her husband JJ, who were married last week. And it was just an unbelievably happy event.
I'd like to ask that a candle of concern be lit for a good friend of mine, Barry, who has a rare ear nerve condition where one of the nerves in his ear is like the nerve in his one of his ears is deteriorating, so he has like constant vertigo, and they cannot figure out how to treat this. So ask that y'all please pray for him and any healing he may hopefully receive.
And we light our last candle.
Oh, I'm a visitor named Peter Sparrow, and my great-grandfather was good friends with Robert Collier. In fact, such good friends that the Church of the Messiah in New York City, Unitarian Church, gave him a grandfather clock, which is in my house. Hello to I'm a fourth generation Unitarian.
And we light the last candle today for all of those joys and concerns which we hold deeply, but which have not been named here.
Today, people will often forget to the best you've got. Anyway, you'll see in the final analysis, it is between you and God. Yeah, yeah, you and God. It was never between you and them.
Our first reading today is from Perspectives, Mythic Stories and Inner Growth by Jonathan Young. In The Wizard of Oz, one of the mentors is Glinda, the Good Witch of the North. As she helps Dorothy learn from the mysteries of the Yellow Brick Road, everyone following the adventure also receives the lessons. We all get to be Dorothy while we are in the story. We learn how to travel on new paths, how to get help, and how important it is to find our way back home. The drama gets intense early on when Dorothy is hit in the head as the tornado reaches the house. After that, the whole story happens in a dream. In general, mythic stories are very dreamlike. As we learn how to figure out what the pictures and stories mean, we are also learning what the pictures in our dreams might mean. When we finally return to Kansas, Aunt Em thinks dreams are silly. Dorothy insists the adventure was real. This idea is worth taking seriously. The things we learn from stories and dreams are very real, in the sense that we find important knowledge about ourselves and how to get along with other people and how to make our lives meaningful. In this way, mythic stories provide mentoring, just like real-life elders. They pass on ideas and advice that will help us on the road ahead. Some of the most valuable learning comes from stories. Our choice of stories says a lot about us. We get to choose the teachers we find in stories. Wise elders from long ago can show us secrets that have been overlooked. Reading ancient tales is a form of time travel. We take a voyage in the imagination to another place. When you spend time with Merlin, you visit early Britain for a while. You see what life is like in the time of knights and noble ladies. When you return, you hold an invisible key that will help you understand how life works. Mythologist Joseph Campbell called the familiar story type the hero's journey. The structure of such mythic adventures involves leaving home, going on risky travels that are full of obstacles that we learn from, and finally returning, changed forever. When we tumble back through the wardrobe after a long visit to Narnia, we are not the kids who were playing hide and seek earlier. We are wiser and stronger now. We know we can survive frightening challenges, and we would not have found this new confidence without going on the difficult trip. Campbell spelled out the many challenges within the stages of leaving, learning, and returning. The result of the journey is a stronger sense of who we are and what we can do in life. What we gain is ours forever. We may never travel to a place quite like Narnia or ever meet a cruel queen, but there are troubles in every life and people that we should not be quick to trust. we are a little more prepared for the tough parts of our stories because we went through the wardrobe to a strange land. There are many variations on the journey trail. It is particularly clear in heroic movies. Usually the central character is pulled into a hard spot. In dealing with danger, knowledge is gained. Even bedtime stories have valuable ideas. For example, Little Red Riding Hood learns not to talk to strangers. In the long run, we are shaped by the stories we love. If you like the Harry Potter adventures, maybe you will be able to do magical things with your creativity. The magical character is like an inner professor of the imagination. If stories about wizards appeal to you, there is probably something that you will be good at, creativity. So when you identify with a character, it strengthens that part of you. If you spend time with stories about courage, you will be in touch with your strength. If you focus on kind tales of generosity, you will deepen your ability to love. You can use mythic stories in very practical ways. If you want to have friends, read about characters who are good at friendship. They will teach you how to do it. In mythology, companions and allies are important. Frodo would never have made it to Mount Doom without Sam, and Dorothy would never have returned to Kansas without her three pals. Many of these examples come from recent stories that follow mythic patterns. The need for wisdom from stories is as strong as ever. Today's artists and writers are trying to answer the same questions as the ancients. So the mythic imagination continues to give us profound tales to guide us through the confusion of everyday life. Here ends the first reading.
Some thoughts from Joseph Campbell. Life is like arriving late for a movie, having to figure out what was going on without bothering everyone with a lot of questions, then being unexpectedly called away before you find out how it ends. People say that we're all seeking a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that we are seeking an experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on the purely physical plane will have resonances without our innermost being and reality, so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive. Please join me now in a moment of silence, meditation, or prayer.
In his work, The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell explored the meaning of life. He said, Schopenhauer, in his splendid essay called On an Apparent Intention for the Fate of an Individual, points out that when you reach an advanced age and look back over your lifetime, it can seem to have a consistent order and plan, as though composed by some novelist. Events that when they occurred had seemed accidental and of little moment turn out to have been indispensable factors in the composition of a consistent plot. So, who composed that plot? Schopenhauer suggests that just as the dreams are composed by an aspect of yourself of which your consciousness is unaware, so too your whole life is composed by the will within you. And just as people whom you will have met apparently for mere chance become leading agents in the structuring of your life, so too will you have served unknowingly as an agent, giving meaning to the lives of others. The whole thing gears together like one big symphony, with everything unconsciously structuring everything else. And Schopenhauer concludes that it is as though our lives were the features of the one great dream of a single dreamer, in which all of the dream characters dream too, so that everything links to everything else, moved by the one will to life, which is the universal will in nature. Here ends the second reading. Please stand in body or spirit and join in singing hymn 1008 in the turquoise hymnal, When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place.
Is it all about anyway? What is the ultimate answer? The answer to life, the universe, the whole darn thing. If you've read Douglas Adams, the answer is easy. It's 42. Unfortunately, as the cast of Douglas Adams, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy discovered, whenever the answer is that simple, you can bet we've either forgotten or never knew the question. William Ellery Channing gave a slightly different answer. He said, each of us is meant to have a character all our own, to be what no other can exactly be, and to do what no other can exactly do. And it's Channing's answer which gives us a place to start today. We are here to be what no other can exactly be. We are here to examine our lives as Unitarian Universalist minister James Luther Adams told us to do. We are here to tell our own stories as truly and as well as we can. Today's readings were long, and they were from mythologists and scholars Jonathan Young and Joseph Campbell. And Campbell quoted Schopenhauer. All of them were examining the same concept, our lives as stories. For Campbell, the quintessential story is the hero's tale. And this is one that each of us knows as well as we know our own face in the mirror. The hero begins humbly. He or she goes into the wide world, conquers obstacles and enemies, and returns at last from the quest wiser, maybe richer, having suffered trials and torments, and experienced the full range of human emotion. Harry Potter, The Wizard of Oz, Die Hard, Eat, Love, Pray. All are heroes' tales of one sort or another. Our own lives are also heroes' tales. Tales in which we make meaning of our experience, grow in our ability to understand what has happened, and make increasingly more complex decisions based on our understanding of the pieces of our own story. Campbell says, life has no meaning. Each of us has meaning, and we bring it to life. It is a waste to be asking the questions when you are the answer. But if we are the answer, then it all boils down to the choices we make, to the lens we create, which allows us to see the world. There's an old joke about a young colt who passes a prospector's old donkey in the street. The donkey is standing fully loaded with mining supplies, its back bowed deeply and permanently under the tools, food, and bedding it has carried for its entire life. The young colt whistles and says, "How in the world do you do that? I could never carry such weight." And the old donkey shrugs in confusion and says, "What's weight?" The problem with our stories, with our lenses, is that the biggest and most important realities are often the hardest for us to see and talk about. We learn not only to ignore the elephants in our rooms, but at times to simply decorate over the top of them. But in this place, in our churches, part of what we are here to do is to learn to make choices about our lens. We learn not how to think, but how to decide what to think about. This seems obvious. We have complete freedom in choosing what to think about, but think just for a moment about that donkey, about that weight. Let's look at a simple, simple story. Two guys are sitting in a bar after a terrible flood. One is an atheist, the other devoutly religious, and they are arguing about whether or not God exists. They have almost come to blows when the atheist says, "Look, I'm not just being a jerk here. I have serious reasons for not believing in God, and they just got confirmed during the flood." Okay, said the religious man, tell me your reasons. During the flood, said the atheist, I got trapped in my house. The water came up so quickly, I couldn't get away. And I ended up on the roof screaming for help as the water got higher. And when I saw that no help was coming, I prayed as hard as I could. I said, God, if you are out there, please help me because I'm going to die without you. And the religious man looked around, now completely confused, and said, but you're here. So that means God helped you, right? No way, said the atheist. That wasn't God. 5 minutes after I finished that ridiculous prayer stuff, a rescue team showed up with a boat and a helicopter and picked me up. As Unitarian Universalists, we are always quick to point out that there are many paths to the same place or different places, and that what is most important is our respect for the other person's lived experience and diversity. This is incredibly valid, but it allows us to ignore the elephant. Where do the beliefs or paths come from? How do our personal, intentional choices allow us to create meaning? Sometimes our lens can be so fixed and we so sure of its rightness that our blind certainty becomes a mental prison and we are held captive in our own rigidity so completely that we don't even realize it's happened. Wait? What wait? These are the lens choices I'm talking about. We are called to examine our lives, to check our lens, to be a little less certain of our own correctness, a little more aware of what we just know. Speaking on the idea of choices, the late great writer David Foster Wallace had this to say to the graduates of Kenyon College in 2005. Here is just one example of the total wrongness of something I tend to be automatically sure of. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe. The realest, most vivid, most important person in existence. We rarely think about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness because it's so socially repulsive. But it's pretty much the same for all of us. This is our default setting, hardwired into our boards at birth. Think about it. There is not one experience that one of you has had that you are not the absolute center of. The world as you experience it is there in front of you, or behind you, or to the left of you, or the right of you, on your TV, your monitor, and so on. Other people's thoughts and feelings have to be communicated to you somehow, but your own are immediate and urgent and real. Now, don't worry that I'm getting ready to lecture you about compassion or other-directedness or other so-called virtues. This is not about virtue. It's a matter of choosing to do the work of somehow altering or getting free of my natural hardwired default setting, which is to be deeply and literally self-centered, to see and interpret everything through the lens of self. People who can't adjust their natural default setting this way are not well adjusted, while people who can are often described as well adjusted, which I suggest to you is not an accidental term. An obvious question is how much of this work of adjusting our default setting involves actual knowledge or intellect. The question gets tricky. Probably the most dangerous thing about an academic education is that it enables our tendency to over-intellectualize stuff, to get lost in abstract arguments inside our heads, instead of simply paying attention to what is going on right in front of us. We pay attention to what is going on inside of me. As I'm sure you know by now, it's extremely difficult to stay alert and attentive instead of getting hypnotized by the constant monologue going on inside your head. I have gradually come to understand that the liberal arts cliche about teaching you how to think is actually shorthand for a deeper, more serious idea. Learning how to think means learning how to exercise some control over how and what you think. It means being conscious and aware enough to choose what you pay attention to, and to choose how you construct meaning from your experience. Because if you cannot exercise this kind of choice in adult life, to quote Wallace, you are hosed. Think of the old cliche about the mind being an excellent servant but a terrible master. This, like many cliches, unexciting on the surface, expresses a great and terrible truth. It is not the least bit coincidental that adults who commit suicide with firearms almost always shoot themselves in the head. They shoot that master. And the truth is that most of these are actually dead long before they pull the trigger. And I submit that this is what is the real value of your education. How to keep from going through your comfortable, prosperous lives dead, unconscious, a slave to your head, to your natural default setting of being uniquely, completely, imperially alone, day in, day out. As we go through our days at work or at home, we are the center of our own universe. We do our jobs and we go to the store and we stop to get some shoes for the kids and we swing into Starbucks for a coffee. And while we wait there in line, getting tired and hungry and a little mad because it's taking so long again, and the kid behind the counter keeps calling out weird names in a flat voice, and why is it taking so long? And now someone is at the counter arguing because while he was getting ready with one drink, someone took hers. And now the line is a disaster, and everyone is checking their cups, and the music is burning a hole through your head. And you manage to smile at that counter kid who turns away, and your smile feels as flat as a board, and inside your head you slam a hand over your mouth so you don't snap at the kid as he takes your money, and then you're on the road. And in front of you are 19 SUVs, a Hummer, and some junker with two different doors that seems to be burning coal. And they're wasting fuel and they're destroying the planet, and the gross consumerism of the world is foul to behold. And you are tired and hungry and you want to go home, and everyone else in the world is an extra in your story, and it's all deeply and personally not fair. Not one little bit. It is so easy to get stuck in this automatic view of the world, this lens that tells us that we are the hero and no one else is really real. Our needs should determine the priorities of the world around us. But this is why JLA says the unexamined life is not worth living. Look at your lens. Check your load. The woman who grabbed the wrong coffee and messed up the Starbucks line has been driving all night to get home to see her mom for her birthday. The man driving the Hummer wrecked his Volkswagen 10 years ago and is proud that he's finally brave enough to drive another car. The owner of the junker is putting her three sisters through college. And the flat-voiced kid calling out names is a 5-year survivor of throat cancer. And everyone else thinks that they, too, are the center of this world around them. It takes effort to move our lenses from their default setting, to realize that everyone is living their own hero's tale, and some of their stories have harder or better or more tedious bits than our own. Some days we won't be willing or even able to look to the stories outside our own, and some days we just won't want to. Other days we will see them effortlessly and be shocked that this view never came to us before. And once we begin to try, we will be able to look differently at everyone around us, to see their story, to honor their experience without rating them based on how important they are in our tale. If you learn how to make choices, how to switch lenses, you may be able to live your values not just externally, but in that space inside your own head. The smelly guy with the ugly tattoo gets recognized as the sweet, sweet man who removed the skunk from your wife's office compound last week. The foolish lady who won't hush her child on the airplane becomes the teacher taking her autistic son on his first flight, delighted and almost in tears because he is speaking his first words in 2 years. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is, and you are operating on that default setting, then you, like me, at times won't consider possibilities that aren't annoying and miserable. But if you really learn how to pay attention, then you will know that there are other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell situation, not only as meaningful, but as sacred, on fire with the same force that made the stars, love, fellowship, a linked web of existence. This is the reality of being well-adjusted. You get to decide what has meaning. You get to decide what to worship. You get to decide what to experience. We choose what is sacred. We choose the lens that lets us see how it acts in the world. We choose the story we want to see and live. We can choose to be the hero, and we can choose to recognize that we are not the only one. We can pick values and ethics and a spirit of divine positivity. These are our myths and legends. We know the parables and the proverbs, the teaching tales, the bones of the classic stories. These are our sacred lenses. The default lenses, the me lenses. Through them, we become lost in darker places where there is no story but our own, and where what is sacred is not relationships but things. Money, power, beauty, prestige, things that we can have, never ever have enough of, no matter how hard we try. Things that we fear losing. It's an effort to change our lens away from things, an effort to put away the base setting. But that effort is real freedom. That choice is real meaning. That lens is the real answer. That is the truth, the simple, obvious, elephant in the room truth. The meaning of life is choosing. The meaning of life is recognizing the weight. Listen to the stories. Choose well. Amen.
we extinguish this chalice and know that together our stories carry light into the world. Please stand, embody your spirit, and join in singing number 100, Peace Like a River.
Into the world of myth, each of us living the hero's journey and learning from the companions who join us in our tales. May our stories weave together in love and laughter, tears and pain, peace, and may it be so.
Anyway.